All right, I'm going to go ahead and start. Again, my name's Toby, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Toby.
Tonight, it's a privilege for me to introduce the speaker. I met him quite a long time ago, right around the beginnings of this group, the 164 group, who came in with quite a few other gentlemen from Sally and in AA and came this way. We had early recovery time together. We've shared sponsees, and we've even shared a car, believe it or not, in some way or another. And his recovery's always been great. There's always been a hint of cynicism to his voice, but underneath it, there's quite deadly earnestness. I love this gentleman. I'm so glad to see him again. He's been working his tail off, so I haven't been able to see him as much as I'd like. And with that, I give you Brett W.
Those of you that don't already know me, my name is Brett, and I am an alcoholic.
Brett.
There's no question there. Let me read you something out of the book. This comes out of Dr. Bob's nightmare, and it's towards the end. But it just describes what he thinks about helping others and why he does it. And what it says... Dr. Bob's nightmare. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. Sense of duty. It's a pleasure. Because in doing so, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And the fourth reason, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And those all sounded like good reasons to me. They didn't when I first considered sponsoring guys and helping others. I was convinced that I wouldn't have to do that. And my sponsor informed me otherwise. Actually, what he said to me was, he cursed at me, actually. He said, "You selfish SOB, you know, you've been given a gift from God. Oh, yes, you are going to share it." And that kind of hit home, and I thought, good point. So I couldn't really argue that a whole lot, and he set me straight on a lot of things early on. Anyway, so what was it, how's that go? What was it like, what happened, and what's it like now, right? What was it like? Well, I grew up in Pittsburgh. It was back in the 70s, it was still a steel town. People worked hard, partied hard, and it hasn't changed any. The steel mills are gone. The mentality there hasn't changed any. It's a you know, blue collar, man's man kind of, you know, thing. And I think that played a part in keeping me away from AA and asking for help for a long time. You know, I was taught very young, you know, you're a man's man, you take care of your own business, be a man, you don't need help from anybody, you handle your own problems, women have feelings, you know, you leave that to the women, you know, that kind of macho tough guy image kind of stuff. And but anyway, along with the hard tough guy image, it went a lot of hard drinking and hard partying. And I started young. My parents were alcoholics, so they weren't evil people or anything. They just weren't around. They had drinking to do, so they were gone. I was the only kid, so I was left to my own devices. And I found at 13, I decided, well, you know, they're doing it. Let me see what that's all about. And I filled up a Dixie cup full of Tanqueray, and I didn't know what that was at the time. I didn't know it was like, what, 90 proof gin at the time. But I knocked it down like I seen John Wayne do it on TV. And, you know, next thing I knew, you know what? Hey, I wasn't lonely. Everything was pretty cool. You know, that sense of ease and comfort, bam, there it was. I found my solution to my problem. And that remained to be my solution for a long time. And, you know, like most of us in the beginning, it worked. Easier to talk to girls as I got older, talked to the girls, had plenty to say with no inhibition, you know, didn't really matter what you said. So probably by the time I was 15, 16, I was drinking alcoholically. There was plenty of booze at the house. I helped myself. Nobody was, you know, drawing lines on the bottles or anything. That when they ran out, they didn't know if they drank it or what, so they just went and got more. So I had plenty of supply. By the time I was probably 17, 18 for sure, I was working in restaurants. Things were different back then. I was able to get into after-hours clubs. I worked at an Italian place, and I knew a lot of, got to know a lot of people and bartenders, and that got me in underage at a lot of places around town. So that didn't help my drinking career any. At the time, it helped greatly as far as I was concerned. It was, you know, fast living, partying, having a good time is pretty much the way I was running my life. I was determined that since I didn't play a musical instrument and I was not going to be a rock star, I was going to live like one. And I gave it a good run. I really gave it a ridiculous run for a long, long time. By the time I was 19, I went to work for an optical company. I was making decent money. I moved at 21. I moved here to Florida. By now, my drinking was daily. When I hit 21 and was able to go to the liquor store on my own, it was really on. It was on all prior to that, but it was really on then. At that point, you know, I'm hitting the liquor store for a half a pint here, a pint there, whenever I felt the urge to drink, which was pretty much all the time. So I basically stayed inebriated. But somehow, I didn't have a lot of consequences. I wrecked a couple of cars. But I just thought that was part of life, you know. All my friends pretty much drank and partied seemingly the way I did and seemingly lived their lives without consequence. It wasn't until later that I found out that they really didn't drink and party like I did. So life continued. A couple of broken relationships. Imagine that, you know, not due to the alcohol or anything, right? I didn't see it that way. It was all her fault. You know, if you had a girlfriend like that, you'd be out at the bar, you'd need a drink too, you know, all that kind of, I had a million excuses, you know. By the time I was 21, my excuse vault was huge. Divorced parents, left alone, this, that, the other, terrible girlfriends, terrible this, terrible, you know, it just went on and on. I had a million reasons why I needed to drink and wanted to drink and liked to drink. So, at 21, I moved to Florida. The economy went to heck in Pittsburgh. I moved down here. I did what all good people do, and I lied on a resume. This is back when you could get away with it. And I embellished my resume, and I got a job working for a big shot surgical practice here in Tampa. I worked for eye surgeons, and they hired me as a technician. Found out about 2 weeks in, the head tech was like, well, what exactly did they teach you up in Pittsburgh? I was like, well, and she's like, you know what, it doesn't matter, you're here now, they hired you, so we'll get you trained up. So I had stumbled into a very, very nice career. And I moved up and got good at it real quick. Started accumulating little plaques on the wall and stuff saying what a great guy I was. And I was a retinal photographer in universities. And all, it got ridiculous real quick. And it went straight to my head. Like many alcoholics, I thought, what does Bill say? I thought quite highly of myself. I had that same problem. Some might tell you I still do, but anyway, it went to my head. At this point, I thought I was just absolutely untouchable. I had defied odds. I picked up my car and my junk, and I moved to Florida. I landed a great job. Now I'm driving a sports car, got a fancy apartment, fancy foreign Japanese girlfriend, and here I am. And still drinking and partying. I won't even, you know, this is an AA meeting. There's obviously drugs and other things involved. And but still living that lifestyle, still trying to maintain that whole lifestyle. And it finally started to catch up to me. You figure I started drinking heavy by the time I was 15. I'm now about 26, 27 years old. And it's starting to wear on me. Now I'm starting to need to drink, not want to drink, need to drink in the morning. And now keep in mind, I'm poking around at your eyeballs and I'm handing stuff to surgeons. I gotta be like this. I'm waking up in the morning and I can't grab my cup of coffee. So I had to make sure, I started drinking in the morning. I had to make sure I had some for in the morning. I ran out at lunchtime, got a half a pint or a pint or whatever I needed to steady me through the entire day. And somehow I did that for about a year and a half, 2 years maybe. I still don't know to this day how I seemingly got away with it. Maybe some people knew and they just never said anything. But finally, I got a DUI. And shortly after that, I got another DUI. It was bang, bang, one run after another within like a year's time. And that was it. It was over as far as my career was concerned. There were suspicions after the first DUI. After the second one, they were all confirmed. And they had to let me go because I could no longer... They took my license for 10 years. I couldn't travel. So... that was it. They had to let me go. So at 28 or so, I now have no career, and everything's slipping away. The wheels are coming off completely. We were going to move to New York or California and do all these great things. Now I'm jobless, can't get a job in the field that I work in. As far as I was concerned, that's it. My life's over. I'm done. It's over. Bury me now. And I proceeded to drink. If you could imagine, drink more. But I did, because that's all I had to do now. I didn't have to worry about work. So I drank the rest of my money up. And it got ugly quick. The girlfriend, she ended up... I gave her all the stuff that we had accumulated, and we packed her into a van, and she drove off to New York. And I took my duffel bag, and I hit the streets of Tampa. So literally within a year's time, I went from the penthouse to Fletcher and 30th Street with a duffel bag. Never been on the streets in my life, no clue what to do, how to survive. not good. Not good. So it was the rise and fall of the way things went with me in my drinking career. The amounts of alcohol, it looks like we got a group of veteran drinkers here. I don't have to get into the amount of booze I drank. Insane. There's no good reason I should be standing here talking to you folks. I spent the next 3 years or so on the streets, basically, learning how to survive from like old Vietnam veterans and stuff, how to not get killed, where to go eat, where to shower, all that kind of thing. At one point, I got tired of that. I jumped. Some guy asked if I wanted, if I minded traveling. I says no. I says get me out of here. So I joined the carnival. Got me off the streets, you know, and the carnival was very interesting. Everything you ever heard about carnies is true. And that, they should be in prison or they just got out of prison. And it just continued the partying, except I traveled around the country now. At one point, I decided I needed a fresh start, and we were in New Orleans. I thought that's where I'd make my fresh start. Yeah. Not a whole lot of sober thoughts going on there. I jumped off the carny circuit in New Orleans and was going to make a go of it there. And, of course, I ended up on Bourbon Street out of my mind for quite a while. But anyway, this went on. Somewhere around 1998, I decided, you know what, maybe I better give some sort of check into this cleaning up my act thing. Because, you know, I had managed to survive on the streets a lot of different places, a lot of different towns, and I always ended up coming back to Tampa. And I decided, well, let me go to the Salvation Army. I didn't decide that. Somehow I ended up directed there. And I checked myself in there, and I hung out, basically, is what I did. It was it's a six-month rehab program, for if you don't know. And I hung out. And I did absolutely nothing. I hung out, and I ate their food, and I slept in their bed, and I worked for them. And I did nothing for my recovery. I figured a nice long break, and I'd be all right. And, well, that obviously didn't work out well. After my nice long break, you know, they gave me a job and everything. They made me a store manager of one of their thrift stores, and it was a nice little gig, but as soon as I moved out with a gentleman. We got in a nice apartment, and about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks into it, I came home from, I had a different job then, I was telemarketing. I came home, and I saw him picking up imaginary things off the floor and peeking out blinds. So I figured, uh-oh, you know. I knew he had a bit of a smoking problem, we'll call it. And but you know, I looked at that and I said, well, you know what, and this is the thinking of somebody with absolutely no recovery. I looked at this guy and I thought, well, there you go, it's all over. Might as well join the party. I went to the liquor store and got a half a gallon of vodka. And here I was again. So within another couple weeks or a month, whatever it was, we're out on the street. I was out on the street with my duffel bag again, fending for myself at the shelters and homeless camps and all the wonderful places you end up. And I did that again. I did that for probably another 5 years. You know, and the stories, you know, I could sit here and talk till tomorrow at the same time, telling you stories of just ridiculous stuff. I witnessed a murder. The guy died in my arms on the streets. Beatings, crazy stuff. Some of the funniest things you'll ever hear of in your life, too. It wasn't all horrible, but for the most part, it was drunken stupidity. I lived to drink. I drank to live. That was my only concern was, where am I going to get cigarettes and alcohol today? And by any means possible, whether I had to steal the money, panhandle the money, I occasionally worked the labor pool, not often, but occasionally. I took another trip out in the carny circuit for another season. Just whatever, just crazy. Did that for another 5 years, and by now I'm getting older and tired. I mean, you know, it's wearing me out. And 2002, I decided I was going to try the rehab thing one more time. It didn't take the first time around was my thinking, you know. Because I guess I was thinking when I was there the first time, just the fact that I was showed up in a rehab, that I was magically going to be cured. And it didn't work out that way. And, well, you know, while we're on the subject of me being out in the streets here, I usually show this when I speak. It usually gets a good response, or an interesting response. This is 2001, or 2000, the year 2000, I believe. This is a booking picture on my birthday. I got busted on my birthday, and I was apparently having a real bad day. They didn't keep me. They didn't keep me in jail. They booked me and sent me to the nut house. I'm strapped down, so you can pass that around. I'm not proud of it, but it gets an interesting response. I usually show that at the beginning before I start to speak, because a picture speaks a thousand words. If I can recover, darn sure all y'all can. So anyway, so I spent about another 5 years out. In 2002, I went back to the Salvation Army, determined that I was going to recover this time. I was going to do what I had to do. And I checked in, and I was serious, you know. I checked in, and I went to a lot of meetings. I went to, you know, meetings at the rehab center, and I went to meetings on the outside. I went to a good bit. And I did read the big book. I read it from cover to cover. I failed to get a sponsor. I failed to work the steps. I was under the impression, still thinking that I'm a very intelligent man. After all, I used to work for eye surgeons. I could read all this wonderful information, take it all in, and with my superior intellect, I will be healed, and I will show you all the way. Yeah. It didn't work out. Didn't work out. After 8 months at the center, they gave me a job again, and I was doing, you know, fairly well, and I got a little place, and I was working at one of the stores again, and I got involved with a woman that was much younger than me, and, you know, it was just one bad decision after another in a very quick sequence, and before I knew it, I was at the liquor store again. So, again, lost the job, lost the apartment, you know, it all goes away. Oh, poor me, and here we go again with my little bag out on Fletcher in Nebraska and wherever, all points across town to the homeless camps. And, you know, it was really bizarre. At that point, I knew where all the camps were. I knew all the people. We saw a guy on the way here that I hadn't seen in a long time. He's still out there. Afro Bill. Anyway. So I did it again. I ended up out in the streets. And it's hard to imagine that it can actually get worse. You think, well, you're living on the streets. That's as bad as it can get. Now, this all started in like 1995. 94, 95 is when I first hit the streets. That's when this whole thing started. How can it get worse than that? Well, you know what? Every time I went back out, it got worse. It got worse. Believe it or not, there's actually social classes among the homeless. You can go as low as you want to go, man. You know, at one point I prided myself on hanging out with folks. And this is an alcoholic thinking here. We obviously, you know, we try to think of ourselves as just a little. At least I'm not as bad as this guy. At least I'm not as bad as that. At least I'm not bad as those guys in rehab, freaking dirtbags. You know. Well, then it became, Well, at least I'm not as bad as these guys on the street. These guys all need to be in a mental house, man. For, look at these nutcases talking to themselves. I'm not that bad off. And, well, then I started ending up in the nut house, strapped down, acting crazy. And, you know, it just keeps getting worse and worse. And my health started to deteriorate. I was having alcoholic seizures when I couldn't get a drink. I was ending up more frequently in the hospital instead of in jail. For the first 6-7 years, I went to jail a lot. I was happy to go to jail. I needed the rest. I needed the vacation and a bologna sandwich and booking. Thank you. I started ending up in the hospital. I should have been dead, I don't know how many times. But I woke up on a respirator a few times. And again, one time in particular, I remember I woke up on a respirator furious because I had money. And when they finally, from me beating and making noise, they finally took the tube out. And I cursed them all out and told them to let me out of this place now, and where's my money? Because I had like $160. And they're all like, they were all astounded that I was alive. And they're like, you can't. And they signed me out, and I went straight to the liquor store. So that's how bad it got. So finally, after a whole lot of that, I woke up one day in Orlando. I will not know. I'm hoping that God will inform me how I got there when I die. He'll fill me in, because I don't know to this day. I was in downtown Tampa. I woke up in Orlando. A week later, days later, I don't know. All I can assume is I was running my mouth, because I was running my mouth about leaving Tampa, and somebody must have been going that way and said, Joe, come on. I woke up on Orange Blossom Trail in a bad part of Orlando. Anyway, I thought, you know, I'm going to try this recovery thing again. I went to a 30-day rehab there, got out, got another job making a bunch of money, and that, again, no recovery. That didn't work out. Left there, got arrested on an old charge, brought back to Tampa, released from jail. And out in the woods again, this is 2006. This is 2006. This is right when I decided I got to really do something. And I was out in the woods drinking what was my last beer. And I really, for a lot of years there towards the end, I wanted to die. I had hoped I would die. I prayed that I would die, and because it was so miserable, and I kept waking up, you know, wherever I woke up, in the woods, under bridges, in the crack house, wherever, it didn't matter. I'd wake up and I'd be, oh man, I'd just be furious that I woke up. And finally, I drank that last beer, and I says, you know what? And I said a little prayer to God. I says, all right, man, obviously you're not going to kill me. Killing me would be far too easy. I was mad at God, too, while we're at it. And I says, what do I got to do? Whatever it is, I'm in. I basically said, you win. Whatever I got to do, I give up. I'm okay. Apparently, I'm sticking around. And the thought flashed through my head, go back to the Salvation Army. So, the next morning, I picked myself up, and I went to the nut house, and I told them, you got to do something with me right now, or I'm going to jump in front of a bus out there. So, they said, come on in. You know, and give us your shoelaces and your belt. I knew the system by now, is what it mainly was. They said we know you. You're not crazy or anything like that. You're an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I says, that doesn't change the fact. If you don't do something with me, I'm going to kill myself. And I had no intention of that. But they sent me to detox. I got down there, and my 3 days were up, and it was Christmas Eve. And they were going to let me out. And I said the same thing. I said, if you let me out of here right now, it's Christmas Eve. People are going to feel sorry for me. There's a McDonald's and a liquor store right down the corner. I'll panhandle up $20-$30 in a matter of minutes. I'll have a half gallon of vodka. I'll end up here in jail or dead before the night's over. And they said, okay, you can stay. And they had just changed the rules down there, and where they would let you stay if you really wanted help and you really wanted placement. They would let you stay for up to 2 weeks until they found you somewhere. And they got me back in at the Salvation Army. And I went up there, and I did what I was told. Like I said, I surrendered my life to God and to AA and to whatever. I just, at that point, alcohol, and what does it say? Alcohol had beaten me into a state of reasonableness. And it took that much. It took all of that. It took all of those years and all of that to beat me into that state. And I pray that it doesn't take all of you that long. But that's what it took for me. And I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I hooked up with Toby and these guys. 164, if it wasn't for 164 group, I'm not standing here right now. I went faithfully to this group every Tuesday for about 4 years. And just a big part of my recovery. I sponsor guys. This December will be 7 years, assuming I make it the next few couple of months. This December will be 7 years. And my sobriety date is December 21st, 2006. That's the first day I actually knew where I was, knew what day it was, when I made it to the detox I was just telling you about. So 7 years down the road, I still do the deal. I still sponsor guys. I try to give back when I can. And when you hear people say, there's a lot of things that used to just make me, I didn't understand and sounded so stupid to me. You'd hear people say, hey, my name's so-and-so and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I said, well, you're a freaking idiot. What are you grateful? You're grateful? What are you, crazy? I didn't understand. I didn't understand what they meant. And I thought they meant they were grateful for being an alcoholic. I can say that today. I'm grateful, actually, that my life path kind of went that way. Because had it not gone that way, I would have had no use for God, no use for helping anybody other than me. I would have rolled right along, being an arrogant SOB with a sports car and a fancy job and F you and get what I can out of this world, and would have died clueless and probably, I don't know, probably be taking a pitchfork somewhere. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous opened my eyes to just a whole different world. I'll wrap it up here. We got about 10, 15 minutes, but I remember very clearly my aha moment. I was in the rehab center and I was reading a Max Lucado book. He's a Christian writer. And I was working my steps, and I think I had already been through my fourth and fifth step just, you know, shortly after that. And it hit me right between the eyes. I was thinking about my entire life, and it just came to me. I was like, you know what? I was just wrong. I was wrong about everything. Not some of it, not a little bit of it. I mean everything. I was just flat out wrong about the way the world worked, the way people thought. I was just flat out wrong. I lived in a fantasy, alcohol-driven world that really was not reality. And I was like, what? And that was a great thing at the moment, but then the thought right after that is, oh boy, I'm screwed. I'm 41 years old. At the time I was 41, yeah, 40, 41 years old. I says, and I'm clueless. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to act. I don't know how to talk to anybody. I know nothing. What do I do? What do I do? And that's where the faith part of the program came in for me. And that's what helped me. Because if I'm wrong and I'm clueless, and I'm also beyond human aid, which makes you all wrong and clueless also, where am I going to turn? Right? Where am I going to go? Well, either the aliens are going to come get me, or I'm going to turn to God for some help, and that's what I did, and the program showed me the way without beating me over the head with any kind of religion or Bible or any of that. Now my faith has grown, and I do attend church and all that, and it's quite different from what it was in the beginning. But in the beginning, I had to come to terms with a lot of things. And anyway, I'm running out of things to say. I could probably yak forever, but it's getting late, and I want to thank you for having me. Let me read you one more thing real quick here. This is another thing out of Dr. Bob's nightmare. And it's a little bit, it's a little harsh, actually, but again, that's what I needed. I needed somebody to talk to me harshly in the beginning. I there's an old guy, Bob Carson. He's passed away now, but he used to scream and curse at me, and I needed that, you know, because you know that whole first step, I'm powerless and life's unmanageable. I still thought I was somebody. And he's the one that said, listen, you dumbbell, you live in a Salvation Army rehab center. You're 40 years old. What do you got? The clothes on your back, idiot. I needed him for him to tell me things like that. Maybe we all don't, but I sure did. Anyway, at the end of Dr. Bob's nightmare, here it goes. It says, if you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you're strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails if you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Thank you. Thank you.